Welcome to this third in the series of podcasts from Techniques in Chiropractology. The article that we're using as a basis for our discussion today is in the February issue of the journal and is volume 21, issue 2, and found on pages 93 to 110, and is by Chirocci and colleagues, and is entitled Laparoscopic Lavage versus Surgical Resection for Acute Diverticulitis with Generalized Peritonitis, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. And it's a contentious subject in chiropractology today, and with me I have David Humes, who is Associate Professor of Surgery at the University of Nottingham in the UK, and is also a holder of the highly prestigious National Institute for Health Research postdoctoral fellowship. And David is an internationally recognised expert on diverticular disease, its epidemiology and treatments. I first asked David to give us a bit of background about diverticular disease and its complications. So David, how common is diverticular disease?
So diverticular disease itself is a condition that becomes increasingly common with age. We estimate that by the time people are 80 years old, 80% of the population will have some evidence of diverticular disease in the Western world. In terms of the complications of diverticular disease, about 5% of patients go on to develop a specific complication. And those complications typically are either perforation, abscess formation, bleeding, stricture or fistula. The most common complication is that of perforation, which has an overall incidence of about 4 per 100,000 person years of follow-up in large population-based studies. So it is relatively common, about the same, about as common as perforated duodenal ulcers in the UK at the moment.
Okay. And so is there anything, a prelude for perforation, anything that puts people at risk?
So the known risk factors for perforation can be broken down into those that are kind of demographic factors, such as an increased BMI. We think that's because patients with an increased BMI, particularly those with a high load of visceral fat, are more likely to secrete inflammatory mediators that predispose them to develop perforation. Mm-hmm. Other risk factors that have been noted are a lack of physical activity, as well as some dietary factors, including eating red meat. The majority of the studies that have shown that have been based from cohorts of working professionals in the US. Yep. That have had two yearly dietary and physical activity questionnaires, as well as questionnaires given to them for outcomes of diverticular disease. So they're all self-reported endpoints. In terms of other risk factors, we know that there is an increased risk of perforation in patients who use corticosteroids, those who use opiate analgesics, and there's some evidence that non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs also increase the risk of perforation. Mm. Studies that have reported those have been either small case control studies from the first of which came from Norfolk, from a group in East Anglia, and then there have been some population-based studies using linked CPRD and HES data from the UK. Mm. And they've shown about a threefold increased risk for those with opiate analgesics and a twofold increased risk for those using corticosteroids.
Are they chronic uses or acute uses?
So you can break the use down into those who are currently using and those who are ever users. The current users usually are those within who've had a prescription within 6 months, have an increased risk compared to those who are ever users, which is what you'd expect. The problem with some of these studies is that they've missed over-the-counter medications because they rely on prescription medications in routinely collected data. Mm. And then those case control studies, which are using hospital cases, are using self-reported medication use. So obviously there may be a reporting bias associated with that. And also the selection of the controls in those case control studies have often been hospital-based, which means there may be other reasons for them having that medication. Yeah. So bias attributable to that as well.
Yeah. So we're going to talk specifically about perforated diverticular disease and the management of it from this meta-analysis. But sort of the fundamental part of that is a Hinchey classification. Could you just run through that for us so we're on the same page?
So the Hinchey classification essentially allows you to stage complicated diverticular disease. So Hinchey grade 1 disease is someone who's got a localized paraclonic abscess, Hinchey grade 2 is someone who's got a walled off pelvic abscess. Hinchey grade 3 is someone who's got purulent peritonitis. And Hinchey grade 4 is someone who's got faecal and peritonitis. So they've got feces coming through the hole in the bowel.
I think we've all seen all of those, but just that's great. Thanks. And so forever since Henri Hartmann described the Hartmann's procedure, I think, in the 1920s, a French chap, wasn't he? Not the same Hartmann that did the fluids, who is an American paediatrician. We've been doing a Hartmann's procedure, resecting the affected part and bringing out the proximal end as an end stoma. But lately, there's been laparoscopic lavage of this. Can you give us a bit of background to the development of lavage?
Yep, so lavage started to be popularised at the kind of end of the 1990s. The first reports of laparoscopic lavage in patients with perforated diverticular disease started to appear. Really came to the fore in 2008 with a publication in the British Journal of Surgery from Professor Winter's group in Ireland, of the use of lavage in a selected series of patients. Their results seem to suggest that in this group of patients who have known comorbidity and who are elderly, they could manage the patients with lavage and avoid the need for a stoma and control sepsis. So there's quite a lot of interest in the results of that series and attempts to try and replicate it. That led to a number of other kind of observational studies reporting their results of use of lavage, which then resulted in a systematic review and meta-analysis of those observational studies, which obviously had problems in terms of the selection bias of the patients who entered them and then the varied outcomes that were reported from them. And that's led to the kind of instigation of a number of randomised controlled trials, three of which have now reported and one of which is ongoing.
So do you have any idea how popular lavage is as a treatment, say, in the UK?
So at the moment in the UK, we don't. We're currently doing some research looking at how many patients are treated with lavage using national data. And that study is ongoing at the moment.
Right. So I remember we did a session together at Association of Chiropractology a couple of years ago, and nobody was doing it very much.
No. Yeah, I think it's not many people. I don't think it's found. I think especially with in light of the results of some of the trials, people have started to shy away from it.
Okay. Can you just talk us through the technique in lavage?
So the techniques vary in the described papers. Essentially, the technique has been to perform a laparoscopy, try and identify that you have a Hinchey stage 3 disease, so just purulent peritonitis. Trials have varied in their attempts to take down adhesions. Some of the trials have been quite keen to remove all adhesions from the colon. There may be problems associated with that, in that you're disturbing the kind of natural barrier that will, or the natural healing process that's ongoing.
That's trying to identify an underlying hole.
Find an underlying hole that won't close with the lavage or using just the lavage. And then most people who've reported on this suggest that actually the removal of any extra fluid is more important than the amount of lavage fluid that you use, and trials have used between 3 and 6 litres of lavage fluid, so it's quite a big lavage, and then the drain is placed alongside the affected segment of colon.
Okay. And so now, so we've got these two treatments, and of course now there's a question of which is best. And so as you said earlier, there's been three trials reported and one ongoing. Could you just run us through those three already reported trials, which are the one that appear in this meta-analysis, and just sort of tell us some important points, similarities, differences, etc.
Okay, so
there's a good summary table in the paper in Techniques in Chiropractic Pathology, isn't there?
There is a summary table. So the Delilah study was the first study to report, and is, I think, the smallest study to date. And then the Scandiv study was from Scandinavia, or from a variety of Scandinavian countries. And then you've got the ladies trial, which reported results from the Lola arm, which is a laparoscopic washout arm of that study. And a second arm, the Diva arm of that study, is looking at resection and stoma formation, so Hartmann's procedure versus resection and primary anastomosis, and that's yet to report. The Lola trial and the Delilah trial had less than 100 patients in total, I think. And the Scandiv trial has just over 200 patients, which is the largest to date. The Scandiv trial tried to limit selection bias by randomising after laparoscopy. However, when they reported their overall results, it became apparent that in the patients who didn't take up the trial, those patients had a higher ASA grade and were likely to be sicker. Mm. So it may well be they've selected a healthier population into their trial than they'd intended to do in terms of generalizability. The ladies trial randomized patients after they'd been identified as having perforated diverticular disease using radiology. That trial ended prematurely because of a concern by data monitors that they had a high reintervention rate in the laparoscopic lavage arm.
And that was stopped after about only a third of patients.
It's only a small sample of patients. So you have to be very careful when drawing any conclusions from that, because it didn't get anywhere near the numbers of patients it required for its primary endpoint. So there'll be problems with interpreting those results.
Mm-hmm. And then so these have been brought together in several meta-analyses now. Yeah. In this meta-analysis, the conclusion is that laparoscopic washout is not inferior, but perhaps there should be some health warnings with that?
Yeah, I think at the moment there are a number of unanswered questions from these meta-analyses. As you say, there are a number of meta-analyses of these papers, and they all conclude slightly different things and have used slightly different endpoints from the studies to get to their conclusion. So the current meta-analysis has looked at complications up to 30 days. A meta-analysis just published in the Annals of Surgery uses all complications and shows a threefold increased risk of reintervention of any sort in this patient group who have laparoscopic lavage compared to those who have a Hartmann's procedure. I think there are a number of outstanding questions now for this area. One is, how do we best select these patients preoperatively? Because all of the studies show that there is a reasonable percentage of patients, up to 70% in some of the studies, who actually have lavage, who don't have any reintervention and have their sepsis controlled, and then longer term don't have any apparent complications at 12 months. So there may be a group that benefit. Mm. I think the authors of the LOLA trial suggested that we probably need to be able to try and select out patients with fecal peritonitis better, either preoperatively, and they suggested maybe CT scans with rectal contrast in this group of patients to see if there's a leak, which may be excessive and may not be available to everyone. They also suggested that at the time of laparoscopy, taking down all adhesions and trying to identify holes that won't close. But there are issues we've already discussed about taking down all the adhesions and trying to identify obvious holes that aren't going to close. There are also issues with regards to what you do with patients who have had lavage afterwards, because there's a reasonable number of these patients will have a perforated cancer. So in the Scandiff study, they had four patients who had a perforated cancer in the lavage group. Mm. So follow-up of this group of patients is extremely important. So I think if you're going to use the technique, your patients have to be clear about what it means. Yep. You're trying to avoid a stoma for them, but there is a high reintervention rate associated with this. So a third of patients needed some form of intervention. Either radiological or an operation. Yeah. So they have to be aware that that's a possibility for them.
And these are often frail elderly patients with comorbidities.
So they may not tolerate these reinterventions particularly well, although none of the studies have shown an increase in mortality in those patients who went on to have reintervention in their intention to treat analysis. Mm.
Mm. So basically, it's having a stoma versus risk of complication and perhaps death with lavage. Yep. So what do you do?
So I tend to resect these patients. Yep. So often the patients that I come across in my practice are elderly, have multiple comorbidities, and actually it would find it difficult to comprehend the risks that I was trying to explain to them in terms of the need for reintervention and actually want a definitive procedure. You have to remember as well that the majority of these patients, even looking at the results in the trial, there's a high mortality associated with this patient group at 12 months. Mm. And that's not due to the surgical intervention. That's due to their underlying comorbidity and underlying performance status. So in population-based studies, up to 20% of these patients die by 1 year.
Yeah.
So they're a group of patients who need, I think, a definitive procedure to get them back out of hospital. And you have to accept that those patients who then do have a stoma, population-based studies show us that only 50% of those patients will go on to have that stoma reversed. But again, that's more a factor of the patients themselves, so patient choice, and then their underlying comorbidity and age, and their ability to tolerate a leak if they were reversed. And we know that this group of patients, when you're reversing Hartmann's procedures, they have a leak rate of 10 to 15%.
Yeah.
So that's significantly higher than we would see in a cancer resection,
yeah,
or we tolerate, because you have abnormal bowel, it's diseased, and you have a group, the patient group themselves are highly comorbid,
yeah,
and more prone to a leak. So
the and there's very people that don't tolerate a leak. So
exactly.
The overall mortality is about 40%. In these, would be
these and that's in, so the high stoma rate and the high permanent stoma rate has to be set in the context of those factors, not just that people aren't reversing these people. There are reasons why you might not reverse these patients, and a lot of the patients actually, once they've been through this type of procedure, and had the difficult time that they have with their Hartmann's procedure, they don't want to have another operation. So they'll say to you in clinic, I don't really fancy having anything else done.
And stomas are quite manageable, aren't they?
Yeah,
most people get on well with them. So you did say earlier that we might over-treat a certain group of people and perhaps they could benefit from lavage. Do you see actually being able to identify those people in clinical practice with confidence?
Well, I think so. It'll be interesting. The last study to report in this area, which is our Lapland study, has a sample size of over 300. And that might be able to address some of the issues that we've seen so far, if they can recruit fully, in that it might allow us to have a look at which patients with Hinchey grade 3 benefited, or whether there are any predictive factors of failure and need for reintervention within those patient groups. But that will be dependent on increasing the number of patients who've actually undergone this procedure within trials, who are well characterized, and then we might be able to combine data to see if there are groups who may benefit.
Okay, David Humes, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.